The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is a perfection of what is not, because space is not something that is. This is a perfection which equals the unequaled, because all dharmas are not apprehended. This is an isolated perfection on account of absolute emptiness. This perfection cannot be crushed, because all dharmas are not apprehended. This is a trackless perfection, because both body and mind are absent. This is a perfection which has no own being, because it neither comes nor goes. This perfection is inexpressible, because all dharmas are not discriminated. This is from a section from the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines that we have incorporated into our liturgy. We chant periodically. It's in the liturgy book. It's a nice example. It's just an exquisite piece unto itself, but it's also a nice example of how we can draw upon the sutras, various teachings, the poems of different masters, going back, Hakuin, Hongzhi, the Lotus Sutra, and incorporate elements, passages into our liturgy. It's a different way of engaging that particular teaching, different way of encountering it. So summer has arrived, it seems, so that you can fully appreciate what we have here. Before heat pumps, before ceiling fans, before fire was discovered, we only had box wall fans in the windows. And you could choose to blow hot air out, or you could choose to blow hot air in. Those were your choices. And they were loud, so it was a little bit like being in an airline hangar. And the best part of all was right before the talk, they would all be turned off. And there would be this measurable blanket that dropped down. So that when we needed to give a name to the August session, because we didn't have one. We had named all the other sessions. And we asked around. The only names people could come up with were sweatbox, endurance. So, no complaints. So, perfection of wisdom. Prajnaparamita sits on the Buddha's right on our altar. The perfect embodiment of non-duality, of all things, being in accord with all things. And so, the perfection of wisdom is what's challenging about this passage is that it's expressing the unconditioned. The unconditioned. The Buddha said, all conditioned existence is dukkha. Conditioned in Buddhism means not arising by itself. And the conditioned existence is everything, anything that comes into being as a result of other conditions, which is everything. The Buddha said there's nothing in the universe that appears by its own, by itself. So there is no self-made person. There is no one who arrives completely on their own. There is nothing in the universe that exists like that. So the Buddha's sweeping statement that all conditioned existence, all existence itself, holds the seeds of our suffering because of our grasping. And so the perfection of wisdom, Prajnaparamita, is to experience the unconditioned. Because everything that is conditioned is dukkha and is impermanent, and so you can't rely on it. As I spoke about the other day, we can do something that brings some happiness, but it's a moment of happiness. It's not lasting. It's not reliable in the sense that it will be there in the next moment. And so it's dukkha, because it leads to disappointment and dissatisfaction and more thirst. And so the Buddha in his enlightenment realized the unconditioned, right? And he my sense, my opinion, is that part of his brilliance was that he understood in advance of his enlightenment that to be liberated, he had to discover something that wasn't the result of any action. Wasn't the result of his meditation, wasn't something that he had done, wasn't something he had created. Because he already understood that anything in that realm would not be reliable, would not ultimately be liberating, because it would, no matter what it offered him in a moment, it would only be for that moment, and then it would dissipate. And so that he understood that the liberation had to arise out of something that was not conditioned, not created. And so how do we come to that experience? How do we practice? How do we apply effort? How do we bring our understanding of the teachings and what practice is? How do we direct our mind? These are all deliberate actions. How do we do that, which are all conditioned actions, within a conditioned awareness, conditioned sense of self? How do we do that in such a way that it brings us to an experience of that which is unconditioned? So we can see practice as a path by which we realize wisdom. We can see it as Zazen, for instance, as a manifestation of that wisdom before it's been realized. We can understand Zazen in any moment, every moment, as a perfect embodiment of Prajnaparamita, realized or not. But I thought, we were actually chanting this last week, and sort of the seed of this talk appeared in that moment, because I thought, what a beautiful passage, and what if we looked at this, each line presenting, trying to express this unconditioned mind, this liberated mind, this perfection. What if we looked at each of these lines from the perspective of Zazen? Right? Because Zazen is to realize the unconditioned, which means ultimately we have to come to a moment where the sense of self, any effort, any intentional action, any intention at all has to drop away. In order to be realized, or to realize, be liberated by that which is unconditioned, is liberated itself, we have to meet it in that very state. In other words, our Zazen has to become in that moment not dependent on anything. So we have to learn how to allow the body and mind and everything to come into that state. You might call it alignment or attunement or perfection itself. We have to learn how to apply the right kind of effort, right? Because it's pretty clear, and the teachings are very clear about this, that if we sit down from the beginning really enmeshed in our habit patterns of a lifetime and try to be effortless, we'll just spin in our habits, because they're just so strong, right? And so it's clear that we have to build some kind of basis, some sort of foundation, some sort of stability, which will mean applying some kind of effort, the right effort, in order to get to a point where that effort itself can begin to drop away. which includes the mind, the awareness, the intention, all those other conditions that are part of bringing that effort to bear. That perfection has to be free of ideas and concepts and striving and measuring. So in that way, we can think of the sutra as pointing to how do we sit, right? When we give instruction in Zazen, we give instruction, right? A kind of linear, this is what you do with your body, this is how you hold your body, this is what you do with your mind, your breath, your awareness, letting go, right? Because we can follow that. But now, having learned that, being practitioners, being in the midst of Sesshin, let's see if we can look at it in this way. This is a perfection of what is not, because space is not something that is. This perfection, this mind, this liberation that we're practicing, this Zazen that we're practicing, ultimately is being likened to space. Vast, boundless, has no boundaries, has no content, right? Has no edges, has no characteristics. And so to sit in such a way that is bringing forth a mind and body that is like space. And because it's like space, this perfection, this Zazen, is Zazen of what is not, which means we have to let go of all the what it is stuff, right? All the ideas and the concepts and the anything else that we create around it, and everything else for that matter, Dharma, Zazen, enlightenment, liberation, which means we have to let go of that functioning mind, which gives rise to the thoughts of what it is. And then on the basis of that, we judge, we compare, we evaluate, we measure. So by letting go of what is not, it's pretty much everything. It's sweeping. This mind, this experience, this. And without turning that into something that it is. And when we do, which we do, which we will, and we will do it over and over and over again, because that is what the mind does, it establishes, it locates, it positions, it identifies, it creates what it is. And so we have to just continue to relinquish, right? Like space. So in the moment that you realize that you're drawing the picture of your face in space, you really don't have to do anything at all, because it's already disappearing. But to not do anything at all, we find out, is not so easy. This is an isolated perfection on account of absolute emptiness. You know, in studying, I spoke about this a couple weeks ago when I talked about Buddha study. You know, part of engaging in teachings that have been translated into English, which means translators have made choices, endless choices, choices, choices about what word best matches, suits, conveys the sense of that, of the word that they're translating. And so here, isolated in English and in the Dharma, we think of that as the very sickness we're trying to heal, right? The sense of being isolated, being separate, distinct, reified. So it can't mean that, right? So sometimes when you encounter language in Dharma that confuses you, because it seems like it's antithetical, it's that understanding which may very well be antithetical. And so then we have to think, okay, it doesn't mean that, so what else might it mean? And that can be just a way of exploring, because it's not always going to be provided an explanation. So the way I see this is that this isolation, which is a perfection, is not that of loneliness or being set apart, but it's isolated as in the sense of being complete, alone, all one, vast space, reaching everywhere. And so in a funny turn of language, it's isolated because there's nothing else. And so to think of how to sit in that isolated perfection, which again is not to isolate yourself, but to sit in aloneness, as though you encompass the whole universe, a solitude that reaches everywhere. To put it simply, you sit in such a way that you mind your own business and you let everybody else mind their own business. Right? And you don't get involved in their business because it's not your business. Right? And just to make sure that that stays on an even keel, we have two people at the back who are charged with getting involved in other people's business now and then, as they need to, and being sure that as we mind our own business, everybody's okay. So to think of that sitting, you know, in this hall, and that's not, I think for a lot of, maybe for most, it doesn't come automatically, right? We're relational beings, we're sitting with each other. We influence each other, we experience and feel each other, even if we're not talking, looking at each other. And so to be able to sit in that solitude, to go so deeply into your zazen that you're not sort of, you know, tethered in your mind to anybody else, can take some time. Sometimes it's a matter of trust. To trust being okay, at ease, in the midst of others. You know, particularly if we have a tendency to sort of project into other people's minds, what are they thinking? What are they thinking of me? You know, those strands can keep very active even though we're not talking to each other, looking at each other. And so it's really just letting those wither, just being in solitude. This perfection cannot be crushed because all dharmas are not apprehended. That term apprehended comes up a lot. So to apprehend something is to obtain it, right? To grasp it, to have it, have something. All dharmas are not apprehended. They cannot be apprehended, right? They are not a thing that can be grasped and obtained. And therefore, this perfection cannot be crushed, cannot be diminished, cannot be destroyed. This mind of liberation, the zazen of liberation that we are practicing, embodying, coming into attunement with, cannot be crushed. What we seek, we already possess. It cannot be given, it cannot be taken away, it doesn't get larger or smaller. When you're thinking Dharma thoughts, it doesn't start to glow brightly. When you're thinking samsaric thoughts, it doesn't start to, you know, doesn't become a red light district. It doesn't change. It's not affected. It's not a thing. It cannot be crushed. And so imagine sitting with that kind of faith, that kind of trust, right? That whatever you're experiencing is not a sign, is not an indication that something is wrong. I mean, this is assuming that you're not having a heart attack. That's why the monitors are there, right? Right? So it doesn't deny common sense. But knowing that everything's basically okay, we practice in complete trust and faith, and that whatever is arising is okay. But you have an opinion about it. So what is it? Can we trust enough to not invest in our opinions? That's not a small request, right? Why would we have opinions if we didn't believe in them? Why would we have an opinion about something that we didn't think was true, was worthy of having an opinion? And so to have that long-standing habit of opinions, judgments, appraisals arise and be unmoved. not caught. It doesn't just happen right away. We have to practice it and keep practicing it and practicing it, right? Sort of divesting. Which, of course, includes self-doubt, insecurity, self-criticism, more opinions. This is a trackless perfection because both body and mind are absent. You know, the training we have received socially, culturally, friends, family, teachers, to track everything, to measure, to gauge our success, our progress, and to gauge and track others, right? And so then to enter into a practice which demands, really, that if we want to fully enter into this, we have to practice in alignment with the fact that that mind of liberation that we seek is trackless. You cannot track it. We can create all kinds of perceptions that we are tracking, right? And that's going to be based on certain criteria that we've established unconsciously or consciously. And so the quality of your thoughts, the number of your thoughts, the quality of your breathing, whatever it might be, the ease or tension of your body. And so we use all of those to track the development. Now, not all of that is incorrect, right? Because we don't want to practice in a way that is kind of, you know, foolish, dumb. You know, we don't want to sit there and think it's intrinsically good, so I'm just going to see it. It doesn't matter what I'm doing or what I'm experiencing, it's good. That's not smart. And so we do actually have to be aware of how we're practicing and what we're experiencing so that we can correct it, we can realign, we can let go, we can develop it. And really, at every point along the way, we also have to recognize when is that actually needed and helpful, which is usually just moments. Like when you're driving, you're veering off the road. How long does it take to notice that and come back in the lanes? An instant. And then it's over. It's done. You don't have to keep thinking about it. You don't have to be then hypervigilant. So it only takes an instant, but we tend not to do that. And so it's recognizing when is it helpful or necessary to track, if you will, and then done. Which is to, because both body and mind are absent, it's letting go of tracking the body and mind. Where am I now? Where am I now? Where am I now? How am I doing? How am I doing? How am I doing? That's why it's important to have a basic sense of confidence that when you sit, you basically know what you're doing. That's not asking. It's asking the right amount of it's right asking the right question. Do you have a basic confidence that when you're sitting, you know what you're doing? I bet you do. And if you don't, or if there are any ways in which you don't, that's what face-to-face teaching is for. And that's part of the teacher's role, is to affirm that that is so. So that when you sit, you don't have to be second-guessing, doubting, constantly checking. This is a perfection which has no own being, because it neither comes nor goes. It's not conditioned. It doesn't come into existence by itself. It doesn't come into existence at all. It does not come, it does not go. We can think of our very awareness in that way. That awareness itself, I mean, there is being aware of something. And so we recognize how that comes and goes. But that's just a moment of perception, of cognition. But the awareness, so let's think of that as just a moment of cognition. But awareness itself, in a more fundamental way, is never absent. It doesn't come and go. And so in that sense, when there's the sense of losing our awareness, we've really just lost our alertness. But the awareness itself is always there. Otherwise, how could we return? Right? If it wasn't there, then when you returned, you would have to go get it. Because it had gone somewhere. While you weren't using it, it had gone, and it was now at the beach, and you have to go pull it off the beach because it's sunbathing. Right? Fortunately, it doesn't take vacations. This perfection is inexpressible because all dharmas are not discriminated. So this is, you know, in essence, these are points that really, most of which are expressed in the very beginning when we first receive instruction in Zazen. And so we always make a point about not judging. Things come up, you're aware, you recognize so that you're not avoiding, you release so that you're not clinging, but you don't judge. And I bet, I'm going to safely bet 100% of us hear that and it's like, doo! Right? We hear it, but we don't do it. Or we do it now and then. Again, why would we not believe in our judgments? Particularly because you didn't decide, okay, I am now going to judge this thought. So that would obviously be a very calculated, intentional, possibly contrived thing that would maybe alert you and say, oh, wait a minute, that's silly, I don't have to do that. But the fact that it seems to just spontaneously arise, as though it has its own being, as though it has its own force, its own intelligence, its own consciousness, as though it's some truth that is coming to us about this. So it's understandable why it's so hard not to believe in it. We've been relying on those judgments, for better or for worse, our whole life. And so to pause that, to not discriminate. And when the mind does impulsively discriminate, to just not judge that. If you wish to see the truth, hold no opinion for or against anything. Hold no opinion. If we're going to do that anywhere, if we're ever going to learn to do that, I think it's going to be in Zazen. Because you don't have to make decisions about anything. Right? You have expressly given yourself permission to not be managing your life or relationships or work or paying bills or whatever might occupy your mind that might require you to discern, discriminate between this and that, make the best choice, plan, and so on. And so we're all relieved of that. And so to allow ourselves to really entrust ourselves that much, trust the Dharma, so that we practice, because it's just a habit. I mean, of course, we all have the capacity to do it. It's part of human consciousness. But the habitual way we do it, right, the almost obsessive way we do it, that's something that we've practiced, mostly unconsciously. So, which simply means that it's a conditioned response. It's a result of, and it is dependent upon certain factors continuing to happen. Well, what if those factors change? What if the conditions we now experience those opinions in are not moving? Seeing, being alert, but not reacting. This perfection is nameless because the skandhas are apprehended. Are not apprehended. skandhas are form, sensation, conception, discrimination, awareness. We chant every morning that they are empty. They have no own being. They are conditioned. They are not the self. That's what Avalokiteshvara is saying when she says form is emptiness. Sensations, perceptions, and so on are likewise like this. What does that mean, that they have no own being? They cannot hurt you. This, just having this body cannot hurt you. Coming into contact, having a sensation, a feeling, a direct experience through one of your senses, that cannot hurt you. When you perceive it, you begin to identify it. That cannot hurt you. When you form a judgment and a plan, a strategy about what you want to do with it, that cannot hurt you. When you become self-aware that all of this is happening, that cannot hurt you. Nor can it save you. Nor can it give you deep, ongoing, reliable happiness and joy. It has no own being. It has no power unto itself. It is conditioned. It comes into being as a result of other factors. The skandhas are not apprehended. You know, we can think of our mental and emotional states kind of like a junk closet. You know, a junk drawer, junk closet. You know, everything else in your place is like, everything has a place except the junk drawer. That's its function in life, is to be that place for everything that does not have a place. Right? Maybe you don't have one. I have one. Okay. So mental and emotional states are not a junk closet. They're not like that place where everything gets piled and accumulated, all of your thoughts and all of your emotions. They just pile up and pile up. And therefore, Zazen is not throwing all that stuff away. It's not organizing it either. Although it may appear like we hoard, and we may feel a weight that feels like the accumulation, and we even speak of it that way, they are not things. One cannot partake of this perfection because no dharma can be seized. This perfection is inexhaustible, linked to the inexhaustible dharma. We cannot partake of this. You know, this is not like a party. You may or may not receive an invitation. If you receive an invitation, you may or may not get there in time for the wonderful food that's been laid out. It may all have been eaten by the time you get there. Right? This is not that. We cannot partake of it. We don't have to worry. Right? It's like giving, like loving, like caring, like awareness, like letting go. You can't run out of that, of those things. Right? The more we practice those, the more abundant they become. So why during Sesshin is it, particularly in early years, that it can seem like, you know, we apply our effort and our concentration is developing and developing, and then towards the end of Sesshin, sometimes there are moments where it seems to all come apart. We've sort of tapped out. I have no more. Right? It's not because we don't have any more awareness. I think it's because the effort that we have been applying, right, has exhausted us. Awareness itself, our capacity to be aware, to be alert, is still there, but our own effort, right? And that can actually be a very important way of helping us to recognize how to refine that effort, right? When we see that it's sort of, we exhaust ourselves rather than thinking, well, I just need to, like, you know, drink more coffee, or I need to, I don't know, go to the gym more before I come to Sesshin or whatever. rather to turn it into a question. It's like, okay, what is my effort? How am I applying myself? How might I be exhausting myself in a way that I don't need to? There is another way. How do I move towards unconditioned awareness, an unconditioned mind? This is a perfection which does nothing, because no doer can be apprehended. This perfection does not generate anything, because all dharmas are without self. This perfection does not pass on, because there's no genesis of death and rebirth. You know, I remember all the times I would hear Dada Roshi speak this way, and I would listen to him and I would think, I don't really think so. I think there is not something. There is a something here. I'm here to get it. Right? There is a generating something here. I need to generate it. It's just hard to believe. It's hard to have faith in. Right? I would say it was even hard to want to have faith in, because I was so doubting of that. It just didn't match anything I had ever experienced or done or contemplated. And moments in my life where there might have been an opening in something because I relaxed my effort was like an accident. Right? It didn't really register. I mean, it registered, but it didn't really teach me anything. Because that was happening within a much more fortified and invested in belief in how things worked and how things got done and how accomplishments were made. And that, a perfection which does nothing, which generates, does not generate anything? It took time. And not just took time, but it took, again and again, in a sense, reaching the limits of what I could do in my own estimation in my pursuit of doing something and generating something. By not giving up my belief and my faith in that, my practice in that way, I more and more was reaching the physical, emotional, mental limits of what that was doing for me. And so I was kind of driven to begin to have faith and begin to try practicing in a different way, really out of fear. Because in sort of reaching those limits, I felt that it began to dawn on me that I could actually sort of ruin my practice in some fatal way. You know, in other words, I could sort of destroy my faith in the Dharma. I could exhaust myself beyond some imagined sense of recovery. The Buddha said there are five essential ways in which we are obscured. The first is to be fixated on desires. And this is not just having a desire, but it's really a fixation, right? So it's not just, I want a thing, but it could be, I want a sensory experience, I want a fixation on my reputation, on my status, on my wealth, on my possessions, a fixation on that. And the Buddha said that's like being in a profound state of debt. It's kind of interesting. You know, that in that obsessive kind of desire and what we want from that, that it's always, we're always in debt. No matter how much we give, we're never paying it off. And the Buddha said when obstruction is abandoned in oneself, it's like being freed of that debt. And so think of that. You know, if you have this enormous debt that's crushing you, and then to suddenly be relieved of that, that state has not been created. It came as a natural response to the relief of giving up that debt. Malevolence. And again, here, it's not just a moment of irritation, but it's really a deeper malevolence. It's really wanting to cause harm, wanting to bring injury to someone, to something, to destroy. A malevolence. He said, that's like being sick, being in a state of sickness, right? It's kind of interesting how the similes he drew with these, how each of these is a very particular state. To be in debt is a very particular state of being that is all-encompassing, right? But is also very particular. To be sick is all-encompassing, right? All throughout the body, but it's also a very particular state. And that when we're no longer, when we've liberated ourselves from malevolence, that's like returning to good health. And we all know what that feels like. It's like, ah. Right? It's a relief. It's a release. It's a kind of returning to something that, in a sense, was always there, but something that had been sort of laid over, dampened that. Apathy and torpor, right? To be indifferent in a very deep way. Again, these are obscurations. These are not just fleeting things. And that's why it's so important in Seishin that we're really practicing meeting these obscurations well. So when we feel our clinging desire coming up, when we feel anger, strong anger, antipathy coming up, that when we feel apathy, indifference, numbness, that we don't just sort of dwell in those. You know, it's really important to really be alert to those and then to try and meet them skillfully. Right? Because you don't want to sit in Zazen and train yourself to strengthen that particular state. That's not going to be helpful. And that's similar, he likens that to being in prison, right? Like you're in prison, and so it's just like a state, because you can't control, you can't go, you have no freedom of movement, right? And so it's just like a draining of all of our vital forces and energies, right? The practice relies upon our life force. And so to be released from prison, it's like, ah. Agitation and anxiety. When we're overcome with that, the mind is excited and agitated. There's anxiousness. He said that's like being in servitude. We're constantly having to be in servitude to somebody else who's not kind, who's not caring, who's not respectful. Right? And so there's always anxiety. We don't know what's going to happen next. We're in agitation. We can't settle. We can't be at ease. We have to be hyper alert. And so that's like being released from that servitude. Right? You have your freedom. And then uncertainty and doubt. And he likened this to being in a desolate country. I think of that. Like deep in the woods or out in the desert. Where you're just, it's desolate. There's no one there. There are no markers. There's no one coming to help you. You don't know which way to go. You don't know how this works out. That sense of uncertainty, of doubt, questioning, lacking in faith, lacking in trust. He said that's like when we relieve ourselves of that, that's like finding ourselves in a place of security, a place of trust, a place where you can relax, you can be alone. And so this training hall is really very expressly designed to be such a place, a physical manifestation, a physical space in which to practice turning towards this mind, this Prajnaparamita mind, this wisdom, and to bring the body along because you can't separate it. To be so at ease, trusting, even within your agitation, within your doubt, within your harsh thoughts or emotions, to be able to meet those in a place of trust. And of course, it's a path, it's a practice. And so all the times we don't do that, of course, don't be surprised. You're not the first. Of course, that's going to happen. So don't ignore it, but don't give it weight. Don't make it into something it's not. Master Dogen has a teaching on perfection of wisdom. In his fascicle on suchness, he says, there's a saying, without wisdom, there's doubt and strangeness. Things seem doubtful, strange. And because of that, eternal loss. Without wisdom, doubt and strangeness, and because of that, there's eternal loss. And then Dogen says, although wisdom is not necessarily present, it's not necessarily absent. At a particular moment, there is the presence of the spring pine and the absence of the autumn chrysanthemum. This wisdom does not seem present, but it is not absent. When this wisdom appears absent, then the great enlightenment seems to become entirely doubt and strangeness. When you do not see the way, you do not see it, even as you walk on it. When you walk the way, it is not near, it is not far. When we are deluded, it seems to be mountains and rivers away from us, strange and doubtful. The way that can be heard, the dharmas that can be enlightened, are none other than doubt and strangeness. That very sense, those very obscurations, when we realize they don't have their own power, they cannot hurt you. So then the question, in a sense, becomes, when something arises, how am I using this in my mind to hurt myself? This thought, this sensation, this emotion, because it doesn't have the power to do that. So it turns it around. And as we begin to discover that it doesn't have its own power, it cannot hurt you, it is liberated from that strangeness and doubt. The way that can be heard, the dharmas that can be enlightenment, are none other than doubt and strangeness. It is not I. It is not you. It is not the self. In all the worlds, there is nowhere that it is hidden. It just appears hidden. And so let's think of our zazen. You know, I spoke earlier this week about, you know, taking refuge. It's not just mouthing words. It's taking refuge, relying upon. That means I'm going to trust the Dharma, right? And as I mentioned, you know, in my own, you know, there were moments where I was consciously not trusting the Dharma. I was trusting what I already knew, what I had come in trusting, what I'd come in believing, right? I had to work towards actually trusting the Dharma. That's okay. We can do that. And so to ask, why am I using this, or how am I using this, to bind myself, to obscure myself, to weigh myself down, to injure, to hold myself back, whatever it might be, that will turn that in the right direction. And that alone might provide a little bit of relief.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.